start off with you, Jed.
So my name is Jed Rakoff. I'm a federal district judge in the United States. That is the trial level of the federal system in the United States. Before going on the bench, I was for 25 years a trial lawyer doing mostly criminal law versus a prosecutor, then as a defense counsel, and then I got so old that they kicked me up to the bench.
Thank you.
I would like to emphasize that I have an academic background, so I have to say
Robert Sharp from Canada. I'm on the Ontario Court of Appeal, jurisdiction of which would be roughly similar to the English Court of Appeal. Before that, I was an academic at the University of Toronto. I did practice briefly, but essentially my career before becoming a judge was an academic. Before I'm being on the Court of Appeal, I was a trial judge for 4 years.
I'm Ross Cranston. As Dennis said, I was a DPhil student here. But actually, Dennis didn't tell you that we both come from the same part of the world, which is across the other side, 10,000 miles away. I was an academic, also a member of parliament for 8 years, and then I went on the bench just over 4 years ago on a high court judge.
Ross omitted to mention that he's also Solicitor General for 2 years, I suppose. 3 years, yeah. So we have a very four judges from very different backgrounds, a lot of academic background, different jurisdictions, and different kinds of courts. So it should be a very interesting day to compare those perspectives. Mm. So I think we will proceed now to ask the first of our speakers, Judge Rakoff, to give us 15 minutes. Now, would you like to use the lectern?
Sure.
So I want to first express my great thanks to being invited to this terrific conference. I was at Oxford as a graduate student from 1964 to 1966, even before the existence of Wolfson College. I was reflecting this morning on what differences I had seen between when I was here and now. I think the main difference is that there are more colleges and fewer pubs, and I think this is definitely a bad development. Some of the folks on this panel wrote papers. I think I was supposed to write a paper, but I didn't. And one of the reasons I didn't was because until I was invited to this conference, I had never really thought about who the courts represent, who do I as a judge represent, both as a trial lawyer and then as a judge. The judges were always, there was that guy up on the bench half asleep who was going to ultimately decide the case, or if I was lucky, the jury would decide the case, and we could forget about that guy. That just seemed to be the role. The role was to decide the case between two competing parties, and you know who you represented in a broader political science or sociological sense was not on my screen. So I've begun thinking about this only in the last few weeks, and I've come to no conclusions. But I am going to offer some thoughts that perhaps might advance the discussion a little bit. So, as I say, the basic role of a judge is to decide cases between, at least in an adversarial system, between competing disputants. And let's take a very simple example of that, arbitration. So, two parties enter into a contract, and in one form, they say, we want, if there's any dispute between us, we want this dispute decided by Mr. Jones, who we have mutually selected. So Mr. Jones, in that little situation, acts as the judge, But who does he represent? Well, he clearly doesn't represent either of the parties. They mutually agreed on him because he didn't represent either of the parties, and they presumably thought he was not predisposed one way or the other. Does he represent, so to speak, the will of the contract, whatever that abstraction may mean? That's too vague, I think, to have any operative meaning. But let's take a second case, a kind of contract that's very common in the United States, where the arbitration clause in the contract says that if there's a disagreement, it will go to arbitration, and each of the parties will select, each of the two parties will select a party arbitrator, and the two party arbitrators will select a third arbitrator who will then collectively serve as a three-person arbitration panel to decide the matter. Now, in one sense, the two party arbitrators are representative of the parties who chose them, but not really. In fact, you see that most arbitration panels are unanimous. The party is selecting someone who they think will be sensitive to their needs, but also will have the ability to influence others because he or she has a sharp mind or a great deal of expertise in the area or something like that. So there is an objective as well as a partisan component to what they're seeking. And then the two of them, the two-party arbitrators, select the third arbitrator. I think the theory there is a little bit like an appointment as opposed to an election. The party arbitrators are ourselves somewhat removed from the fray, and we know who can be an unbiased, neutral arbitrator who has a lot of expertise, and we'll select that person to be the neutral arbitrator. So, again, to speak of any of those arbitrators, and particularly the neutral arbitrator, is representing anyone other than the system designed by the contract is, I think, artificial. So let's turn from that very simple example to the courts. Now, there's an obvious difference between arbitrators and courts in that arbitrators are selected, the function of a private contract, whereas courts are imposed. They are imposed as a matter of law. And so in that situation, the everyday situation, there is surely one entity that the courts are representing, and that is the sovereign that they are appointed or elected by. In the United States, this is very important because we have a federalist system, and there's all sorts of complicated rules to determine whether state law or federal law applies. Sometimes I am obligated, even in a federal case, to follow state law. Sometimes state judges are obligated in a state case to follow federal law. But what is being asserted there is the power of the sovereign. And of course, historically, this is the origin of courts both in England and in the United States, the king's courts. And then the courts in the United States. And I think it's a major reason why governments will support courts and enforce their judgments even when the government in power may disagree with the particular decision. Because what the courts represent in this sense is the overall power of the sovereign, the power to resolve disputes according to the rule of law ultimately set by the sovereign, and not to allow chaos to reign. And, you know, the classic example in the United States was during the Civil Rights Movement when President Eisenhower, who was no big fan of the decision of the Supreme Court, Brown v. Board of Education, that integrated the schools, nevertheless sent the National Guard in to force the integration of the schools in Little Rock. He did so because it was the challenge that was being raised by Governor Faubus of Arkansas was a challenge to the sovereign power of the United States overall, and that was not going to be permitted. So in that very basic sense, courts represent the sovereign. Where this sort of simplistic analysis kind of breaks down is when you look at the role of the courts in making law. So Chief Justice Roberts has said courts don't make law, they are simply umpires who call balls and strikes, they apply the law. You can draw your own view of that, but I think most objective observers would say that courts do make law. There are a lot of reasons for that. One reason is that many statutes are hopelessly vague or can reasonably be interpreted in either of two directions, and the determination of which direction to interpret it is ultimately often a question of policy and therefore a question of the law-making function of the judge. Another typical situation is where the two branches of government, the executive and the legislative branches, are in conflict. And in making, in choosing between them, in effect, in choosing, for example, whether an administrative regulation exceeds the legislative grant, a court is often, in effect, making policy decisions of a lawmaking sort. And then the third classic case, of course, is judicial review. In the United States, the states, as many of you know, from Barbary versus Madison, where Chief Judge Justice John Marshall declared that it is emphatically the role of the courts to say what the law is. Maybe what that could be translated as, the law is what I say it is. And that's sort of how the Supreme Court operates within limits. And those limits are important, but they are not absolute. And so there is a lawmaking function. And so then the question becomes, if judges to some extent make law, shouldn't they, in a democratic society, be directly responsive to the people? The United States is one of the few countries that has taken that idea to its natural conclusion. In 38 states out of the 50 states, the judges are elected. New York, my state, is a partial version of that. We elect two levels of the judges. We don't elect the very highest level. It's a good way to put the theory to the test. Putting it to the test, you see that the theory has failed, or maybe a better way to put it is the judges who are elected in the United States are, I think, almost unanimously viewed as not as good. There's some very good ones, but not as good as the judges who are appointed. And are not particularly viewed as representatives of the people qua people. So why is this? Well, again, using New York as a good example there, and in most of the 38 states where judges are elected, they are nominated by the political parties. The people who go to vote don't know a thing about who these judges are. The media doesn't follow these elections. Very few people, the main people who were interested in are the relatives of the competing candidates. So you go in the election booth and you vote basically on the basis of which party had nominated the judge. That's the only salient fact most voters know. The result is that the party, the political parties, control who are the judges in New York, and they often nominate some very skilled people, but the most important component, the most important qualification is whether the judges have done, have served their time as party stalwarts. So these are very much politicized candidates. Now, in some states, parties are forbidden to nominate judges. There's an opinion I recently wrote that is part of the on the website here that I can't really discuss because federal law says you can't discuss pending cases. And although the case is decided so far as the Court of Appeals is concerned, the parties have already sought what they call en banc review. But it's a case about Montana, which has judges who are nonpartisan in the sense they are not allowed to be nominated by a party. But what's the result there? The result there is that money controls the election. The only thing that people know about these judges, who are basically unknowns, is what they learn in campaign ads, and the person who mounts the greater campaign ads is often the person elected. An extreme case of this occurred in New York. It used to be that the highest judge, the highest court there, consisted of elected judges like the lower courts still do. A fellow named Jacob Fuchsberger, who was a prominent lawyer in New York, decided one day he was tired of being a rich trial lawyer. He wanted to be a judge. So he went out and spent many millions of dollars campaigning. No one had ever heard of any of the candidates for this highest court, but they saw his ads day after day on the television. You remember the television, that's what we used to watch before the web. And he got elected to the highest court. And that was too much even for the New York State Legislature, so they changed the law so the highest court is now appointed by the governor. My point is not that these judges are bad. They're often quite good. They're not as good as the appointed judges. But they are, in the case of the politically appointed or politically elected judges, to some extent beholden to the party. There's a study that is part of the materials here, which shows that these judges in several states that were studied classically are quite independent for most of their term until they're a year or two before their election. And then they become very sensitive, and they tend to not be as independent as they previously had been because they don't want to do something unpopular that will mean that they won't get re-nominated or re-elected. And there are variations on that same theme even in states where it's a nonpartisan election. So you might ask, well, do not different kinds of pressures operate with respect to appointed judges? After all, when the president nominates someone to the Supreme Court, he's looking for someone who's going to be representative of his particular political ideology. And, of course, the answer to that is yes, that's true. But the studies, again, suggest that a very substantial number of those judges change their minds after they're on the bench. And I think, in all fairness, I've really never met a federal judge who sat down to decide a case based consciously his or her ideology. Obviously, we're all human beings. Obviously, ideology operates. But it is not part of what they consciously think about, I really don't believe. So is there any respect in which judges are consciously in tune to who they represent, as opposed to just being folks up there who have to decide the case. At least in my experience, just in one respect, and it's a function of the judiciary's role in the federal constitution as one of the checks on the other branches of the government. I do think many federal judges, and it's certainly true in my case, are consciously aware that we are the only people who can speak on a day-to-day basis for the powerless, for the unrepresented, for the people who are not in ascendancy in our society. Now, 9 out of 10 cases don't present an issue where that is relevant. But where it is relevant, I think that is something that most federal judges are acutely aware of, that because the legislature is elected, because the executive is elected, those branches of the government are going to be particularly responsive to what the majority wants. And the only branch that can be protective of those who are in the minority is the federal judiciary. This is why we're given lifetime tenure. This is why we're given the provision that our pay cannot be diminished. It's to enhance our independence. And what does independence mean? It means the ability to do something that is unpopular, but that you think is mandated by the law. And more often than not, that something is protective of a group that is not in ascendancy. So,
Judge, don't interrupt me, your time is up.
My time is up.
Thank you.